Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff. In a legal face-off, hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah. One love, you know. The lawyers in the house.
It's the first episode of Legal Face-Off in the 2017 calendar year. Welcome to it. Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside, your legal eagles in studio here at the Tribune Tower. Craig Collins sitting across the glass. My name is Sam Panionovich. We will talk about the newest 20 laws in the state of Illinois for 2017 in a jam-packed legal grab bag. But first, we go out to the phones. He is the 64th Sheriff of Milwaukee County. He is Sheriff David A. Clark, Jr., and he joins us on Legal Face-Off. Hello, sir.
Good afternoon. It's great to be on with you.
Sheriff, it's an honor. Thanks again for coming back on our show. We're going to jump right into the Chicago torture video that, you know, blew up the internet, that everyone's seen multiple occasions by now. What are your thoughts on that, and what are your thoughts on how the Chicago police handled this whole situation?
Well, first of all, you know, I think we end up, when these things happen, we end up working on the wrong thing. You know, I heard a lot of back and forth over the last couple of days. Is this a hate crime? You know, is it politically motivated? What should be done? So on and so forth. And we step over the body that's on the ground, or what I like to call sometimes is the elephant in the room. And it's the subculture that exists. This is not just synonymous with Chicago, by the way, but the fact that it happened in Chicago, and with all the violence that happened last year, the black eye gets put on the city of Chicago. But this is happening on a daily occurrence in every ghetto in America, any large urban area, whether it be Baltimore, New York, L.A., Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, they're all experiencing these levels of abhorrent behavior from our young people. I know the suspects in this three are 18, I believe, and one is 24. And the question I have is, you know, who raised these miscreants? I mean, you know, violence is a learned behavior. And when you look at the dysfunction that exists in the American ghetto, what I call it, not totally, I don't talk in terms of all black people that live below the poverty line, or all black people that live in the ghetto. What I'm talking about, a growing and emerging black dysfunctional subculture where these behaviors start to exhibit themselves. You know, we're all appalled, but at the same time, I mean, I know these individuals go to prison for a long period of time, but it's not going to prevent the next one, because we won't deal with the urban pathologies that exist. They don't cause crime. They don't cause violence, but they're risk factors for that. These areas are symbolic for inescapable poverty, high unemployment, especially in the black community, school failure, dysfunctional families, too many kids growing up in a dysfunctional environment, single parent or ineffective parenting. And until the city deals with those pathologies, we're going to continue to see this on a more frequent basis, unfortunately.
You know, and you touched on it briefly, Sheriff, 762 murders in Chicago last year, more than New York and L.A. put together. And as you were explaining, you know, the problem, what's the solution for the city of Chicago with gun violence and, you know, all the socioeconomic issues that you mentioned?
Sure. Well, you know, I talked about it a little bit when I talked about the generational poverty, school failure, so on and so forth. Those are issues that the political class in these areas, the urban ghetto, are going to have to deal with. So I'm talking about the mayor of Chicago. I'm talking about the mayor of Milwaukee, the mayor of Baltimore. They have to come up with a strategic plan to reduce poverty, to put people back to work with meaningful jobs, by the way, meaningful employment. And then some of this, remember, I said this was a dysfunctional black subculture. Some of the cultural aspects, embracing school failure, staying out of the workforce, gang, you know, questionable lifestyle choices like gang involvement, drug and alcohol abuse. That's got to be done by the individual. So until the political class in these cities come up with a strategic plan to reduce those, you know, the police, we can arrest until the cows come home. We can arrest all the people that need to be arrested, but the pipeline has to be cut off, and that's that dysfunctional black subculture that exists. So, you know, I looked at you know, I watched a little bit how the Chicago superintendent, Johnson, I believe his name is, you know, in terms of, you know, how he handled this, I don't know, how do you handle it? But the thing is, I was hoping that he would talk on some of the things that I just mentioned that have to be dealt with in Chicago. You can hire another 5,000 police officers. You can fill up the jails. You can fill up the prisons. But again, if you don't cut off the pipeline, you know, you're just going to be spinning their wheels. One of the things that Chicago's finest, the Chicago police officers, one of the issues for them is they have their hands tied. All right, this consent decree that was signed by former superintendent Gary McCarthy, I believe his name is, I thought it was misguided. I thought it was an attempt to appease. It now ties the hands of the Chicago police officers. I looked at what's called the investigatory stop directive that requires after every traffic stop or every field interview stop, we call them stick-ups, that's the police jargon, when you do a field interview stop, after every police contact, this very labor-intensive report has to be filled out each and every time that happens. That is discouraging to a police officer. I believe that something needs to be documented, but if you do it by the form that the US DOJ wants, what you're doing is you're tying these police officers up. You're making them data collectors instead of crime fighters. They're spending more and more time on administrative stuff, data collection and filing reports than they are on visible patrols, getting to know the people in the community, meeting with people. They don't have time for that anymore. So police officers get discouraged. They're making fewer stops. I know the data exists in Chicago to show this because I've talked to people from the Chicago FOP. They have the data. You have fewer Chicago police officers engaging in assertive policing, which keeps the criminal on the run, keeps people from hanging out on corners, cuts down on drive-by shootings, illegal weapon possession, and transporting them in cars and drugs and people wanted on serious felony warrants. The cops just give up, and they just say, hey, I make a stop, and then I spend 2 hours just writing the thing up, and they don't even make an arrest. You know, it's just because they made this contact. So that's why I think that thing was misguided. These things have to be looked at. They got to go back and say, hey, maybe we went too far in the other direction because of the Laquan McDonald's case, which, by the way, is Rahm Emanuel's fault. He should be held accountable for that. I think there should be an investigation by the Chicago Attorney General as to was there some misconduct that went on there on the part of the mayor of Chicago in withholding that just to win an election. So now the Chicago Police Department is paying the price for that, and ultimately the good law-abiding people that live in these minority and poor communities are paying the heavy price in terms of being victimized by violent crime.
So you mentioned Eddie Johnson, who is, in fact, head of the police department here in Chicago. We saw him yesterday during the press conference. And the day before when this first came to light, he was heavily criticized on social media and many here in the media in Chicago for not coming out right away and stating that this was a hate crime. If this happened on your watch, and you had this video where the attacker shouted, F white people, and the victim was a special needs teen, would you have come right out and said that this was a hate crime, or do you think that Eddie Johnson handled it correctly?
Well, you know, I want to be a little careful because I don't have all the information that he had. However, saying that, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Of course it's a hate crime, but that's just an enhancer anyway. That doesn't solve the real issue that needs to be dealt with here. How do we reduce this the size of the black dysfunctional subculture that exists in many neighborhoods in the city of Chicago so that we don't see a recurring incident of this? And, you know, the number of murder victims has been going up year after year after year. And so that tells you that they're not dealing, and I don't call them root causes. Forget about root causes. I'm talking about risk factors that lead to kids growing up without fathers. We know that when a kid grows up, a young boy grows up without a father to help him socially develop, he ends up turning into a unmanageable misfit that the police and the criminal justice system have to deal with. So, you know, let's talk about those sort of, that's what, how I would have liked Superintendent Johnson to talk about is some of these urban pathologies and put this on the political class. Hey, you've tied the hands of my officers on the street because of this Laquan McDonald case, but of course, he works for Rahm Emanuel. He can't throw Rahm Emanuel under the bus or he'll be gone. So his hands are kind of tied, but at the same time, this should be important enough to Superintendent Johnson. He says, the heck with my career. I've led a good career. I can retire tomorrow. Let's start identifying these things and where the accountability needs to be. Sure, the police department needs to get better. Sure, they can improve in several areas. But until this, the Chicago City Council, the Chicago political class, the state reps, state senators that represent the area of Chicago, until they come up with a plan to reduce the poverty, fix the damn failing public schools, put people back to work in meaningful jobs, and then put the pressure on the black community to look inside themselves and start behaving differently. Until that happens, we're going to see this over and over and over again. But, of course, he doesn't have the freedom to talk like that I do. And I say I do because I'm an elected official myself, and I'm only accountable to the people. I'm not accountable to a mayor or another county official.
You know, and Sheriff Clark, we saw Donald Trump come out with a tweet after the murder rate was revealed. He said that if the mayor can't do it, he must ask for federal help. What federal help is available for the city of Chicago that, in your opinion, might help curb the violence or decrease it?
A lot. And I'm glad that President-elect Trump has put the spotlight, and he didn't just do it in Chicago. It happens to be Chicago now, but in every major urban center in the United States that has a ghetto. Milwaukee's got their problems, too. We've had high levels of violence, some signature cases. We had riots this past summer. But he's putting the spotlight and pressure on, because the president has to walk delicately on this, because there is this thing called federalism, and there are issues that are germane to the state. The state of Illinois has a vested interest in controlling crime, and they need to get the first shot at this. However, if the governor, and I believe Governor Rauner, is unfortunately sitting on his hands on this or standing on the sidelines, and he cannot do it. But here's what the federal government can do. I think it is a step in the right direction to have appointed Jeff Sessions as the next attorney general, because where Trump can get this done, President-elect Trump, is through the attorney general's, the Department of Justice and the United States Attorney General. We work closely, as they do in Illinois, with the U.S. DOJ on task forces, okay, to go after violent crime, to go after career criminals, to identify these individuals, charge them with federal violations, and lock them up for the longest period of time available by law in the federal system. Okay, so it's those resources, those task forces. But really, Rahm Emanuel does have to go to the DOJ. He doesn't have to go to the president. He can. He can go to Congress if he wants. But all he has to do is call up the attorney general and say, look, let's get a task force going over here. I'll commit all of my resources. You commit your resources from the prosecutorial end, because the feds don't know how to local police in a local community, but they can do the prosecution end. They can do the debriefing of all these individuals. Every time one of these individuals is arrested, you need an extensive debriefing. You need a task force units that go out and do heavy traffic stops, because a lot of this stuff emanates out of a car, the drive-by shootings, the drugs being transported. You need to do warrant sweeps. All these people that are walking around these neighborhoods, Garfield Park, for instance, in Chicago, they're wanted on serious felony warrants. You sweep them up, you arrest them on those warrants, and then you have to do a heavy debriefing. That's where the FBI can come in. They're good at interviewing. So there's an opportunity here. But, yeah, Rahm Emanuel has to make the call and say, let's get something going here. But it doesn't seem that he's real motivated to do that right now. I think it's a shame because, like I said, in the end, it's good law-abiding black people that are overrepresented in terms of victimization in terms of violent crime.
Sheriff Clark, about 60 seconds left here on Legal Face-Off. You've been very prominent in a lot of media over the last couple of years. You're a star on the O'Reilly Factor on Fox News. Give us a break here. We're a small podcast here. We're a legal radio show. Break some news for us and tell us the position that you're going to take in the Trump administration. You're a very prominent Trump supporter. You spoke at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Give us a scoop here. What will we expect to see from Sheriff Clark in the upcoming Trump administration?
You can hear it already.
Well, you know, I hate to disappoint you guys, but that's going to be up to President-elect Trump. My name is being mentioned for any number of things. I don't know. I'm I'm willing to serve this president if he thinks there's a role for me to play in his administration, and he does. He's articulated that or communicated that, but that's going to be up to him. This is not about me. I never supported him with any strings attached. I never said, hey, I'll support you if you give me a job. Look, I got a job. I'm the sheriff of Milwaukee County. I love what I do. I do have a platform, like you mentioned, to get my message out. So I got to be patient right now. And if the president, then president after January 20th, picks up the call and says, hey, I need you in this area over here, I will accept it.
That's Milwaukee County Sheriff David A. Clark, Jr., also an author now. The book comes out in February of 2017, Cop Under Fire, Moving Beyond the Hashtags of Race, Crime, and Politics for a Better America. And Sean Hannity wrote the foreword, so we'll look forward to that. Thank you for your time, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Follow me on Twitter, at Sheriff Clark, and you can pre-order that book on at Amazon.com.
All righty.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Be sure to listen to Legal Faceoff on iTunes. Find us on Facebook at Legal Faceoff. Also on Twitter at The Legal Faceoff. Make sure to rate, review, and share with a friend. Well, there are 20 new laws in Illinois for 2017, and to talk about it, freshly minted at WTTW, a correspondent, but she spent a decade covering politics, mostly in Springfield, Illinois, Amanda Vinicky with us on LFO. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Amanda. We're big fans. We're happy to have you on annually here on Legal Faceoff as we enter our, third year. We talk about any interesting new legislation happening in our state, and this is no different. So jumping right in, there's some interesting developments with police regulations. We just talked to Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark about some issues going on with the police, and there's a new law that establishes regulations for body cameras. It doesn't require that police use body cameras, but it does establish some regulations that to use if they do. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, well, so the bulk of the work regarding law enforcement was done some time ago. Obviously, there was the Laquette McDonald situation, and you've seen Illinois legislators be careful with how much they touch that package to see how it all comes to fruition. And I think this is still new in scope. The real big takeaway that we, I think, should be aware of is that they aren't required still in Illinois. So look for that now in the new year. That, though, obviously costs a whole lot of money, something that both state government and local municipalities don't have a lot of. So I would say that is something to be aware of in the future and something that you would likely see a lot of pushback from with the police union. Thus far, though, everything that has passed from the General Assembly has been really via consensus between law enforcement and those that say that law enforcement needs to be more either restricted or at least closer watched.
I was surprised by this one. There was about DUIs. I was surprised by the idea that there was 5,000 offenders in Illinois who have been convicted four separate times of DUI who are currently banned from driving. New legislation will require those kind of offenders to use a device for the rest of their lives that requires them to take a breath test before starting their car's ignition.
It is kind of frightening to think that we share the roads with anybody who has seen fit to drink enough that they'll blow into one of those breathalyzers, be able to receive a citation and land themselves behind bars, and then get in trouble not once, twice, thrice, but four times. It is scary, and yet you also saw legislators talk, for example, about, okay, what happens if somebody did that long ago and now they've reformed and they've seen themselves be, you know, remedied, and they want to be able to hold down a job. Can they get behind a car? And so it's a difficult area for legislators. Obviously, all of this can and often is turned into a campaign brochure, and therefore any of those votes that seek to lift requirements from anybody who's received a DUI are difficult, but we saw some action there. And then, obviously, on the opposite end of things, it's easy for legislators to say that they are going to raise the penalties, in particular use technology to require those interlocking devices to try and keep the roads safer. Do know a couple of individuals that have those on their car. I once was in one and watched as a pal blew into his breathalyzer interlock device, and then the car started. I was, at that point in time, I have to admit, not at all frightened for my life, but I guess any little thing that you can do to try and make sure somebody with that big of a problem is not driving intoxicated is a good thing.
Yeah, you know, Amanda, as a plaintiff's attorney, one of the laws I liked was the they call it Molly's Law, and it extended the statute of limitations for bringing a wrongful death lawsuit from 2 to 5 years. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's a really sad situation involving a woman in southern Illinois who I believe was actually killed by a former boyfriend who was some sort of first responder, or perhaps worked at a call center, or like a 911 call center. So it was pushed for very hard by a lot of her friends and family seeking justice, and thereby known as Molly's Law. I don't have the legislation in front of me, but this, of course, comes as there is a lot of talk from Governor Rauner and, frankly, from legislators on both sides of the aisle about trying to reduce the state's prison population and all of that. But so some difficult votes when it comes to criminal justice ahead, but this was not one of them. Again, a very easy vote, I think, for legislators who saw this as helping to bring justice to a woman whose life was sadly cut short too soon.
Yeah, we've also covered on this show several prominent examples of minors who've been charged with crimes. There's a new law in Illinois that requires legal counsel during the interrogation of minors under the age of 15 who are charged with murder. There was a very famous case in Milwaukee of some minors being charged with murder. They're given some additional protection now under SB 2370.
Yeah, so there's that one where my understanding that you previously had to have an attorney present if you were a minor, and that was considered 13 or younger, but now it will be anybody who is 15 or younger gets that kind of extra protection and make sure that they are read their Miranda rights. That's something, obviously, it applies to everybody, but extra precautions taken for youth who might not know. And that's just one of several pieces of legislation really having to do with juveniles. The thought being that minors, A, might not know what they're getting into. I don't know. I, of course, binge-watched Making a Murderer. And I think that brought to light a lot of those instances. Everybody that's listening to this probably did, or if you haven't, I do recommend. It's an interesting watch. But there's plenty that goes on, not just from that, but these are developing minds. So much action, both in law and in rule before the Illinois Supreme Court this year when it comes to juvenile justice. For example, no shackling. There's also a new law that expunges more juvenile records and better allows anybody who had an arrest and a crime before their 18th birthday to petition for more of a full expungement there in hopes that they'll be able to get a job and lead a better life later on. And as I mentioned, those are really just a couple. This is something that the legislature is really digging its hands into.
Yeah, and one law that I saw, Amanda, was the declaring a state artifact. So we now have a canoe.
Oh, the pirogue. Pirogue, I think is how it's called. But
yeah, like
a canoe.
Please tell me the legislature didn't spend an immense amount of time declaring a state artifact.
Big debate. No.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, and as I would have to check back, but I believe this is the case, most of the time you get this coming from school groups. So you'll have a legislator, and they are talking to a classroom of students, and as a project to learn about how a bill becomes a law, their teacher is somebody who's an overachiever and does not want to leave it at that cute little video where you have the dancing bill, and instead uses this as an opportunity to really demonstrate to students how a bill goes through the legislative process and then is actually signed and becomes part of the books in Illinois. And that is how we now have things such as an official state pie, the pumpkin pie, as well as now an artifact, a pirogue, which, as I noted, is something like a canoe. I'm not sure if you are able to get one or if anybody wants to try their hand at that on the Chicago River, but that's basically what they look like, a wooden canoe.
I don't like pumpkin pie. Do you guys like pumpkin pie?
No.
No, I mean, I like it at Thanksgiving. I think that's when I ate it.
I tried it, like, for the first time recently, believe it or not, and I wasn't a fan. I thought there was one more interesting one, Amanda.
Can I add?
Are you a pumpkin pie person?
I'm not a pumpkin pie person.
Uh-huh.
At all, and really not a pie person. I'm more of a salty than sweet, and I mean that with food, so be nice, listeners. That's not what I mean in terms of personality, although some politicians may care to dispute that characterization. But I like pumpkin spice lattes, and it does make sense, that one especially, because Illinois is the number one producer of pumpkin, so we don't need to limit it to just pie all over the place. We are the pumpkin capital, and there are a couple of pretty fun pumpkin fest, if anybody wants to travel down to central Illinois and take part in that next fall.
Here's one
my pumpkin shout out.
Yeah, we'll take the trip down to Springfield.
Are you going to tell her how upset we are that they're prohibiting bath salts? That's a huge part of Legal Face.
Well, that's a big one that we were going to cover. And also, I thought this was interesting that now hairdressers.
You can take very fancy schmancy baths if you are somebody who is lucky enough to have a jacuzzi or something of the sort.
Every time
they pass a law prohibiting some form of new synthetic drug, a new form of synthetic drug pops onto the market, evidently legally at first, which is why they need to make it illegal. I don't know how many people that dissuades from using or making said drug, but you get a lot of those on the books every year.
Yeah, I thought this one was interesting, that hairdressers, nail technicians, and similar kind of people are supposed to take 1 hour of continuing education to spot signs of domestic violence or sexual assault in renewing their state license, which, you know, makes some sense, because if those are people who are, you know,
they're
probably
gonna
get a spot. Spot those kind of things. So,
but they don't have to report it, though, right? I mean, they just have to.
They have to, it says, spot signs and provide clients with resources. So, yeah, they don't have to report it, but they're required to take this 1 hour to help their clients.
Yeah, you know, it does make sense. And a lot of people are pretty close with their beauticians. Obviously, they're dealing with that and, you know, have access to when you're 2 centimeters away from my face plucking my eyebrows, you are literally close. But also, those are often times that you may have an established relationship with, where you go and you get your eyebrows done and your hair trimmed every 6 weeks. So it does make sense. And this is one where my reporting would say that the reason that it's not required is because, obviously, these are beauticians. They aren't certified counselors who've gone through years of training, and when you sign on to work at a salon, you're not necessarily signing up for all of that. And Illinois has become a bit more wary, I think, in this day and age of mandates and such. So the 1 hour requirement as part of continuing education is seen as a sort of compromise, something that is important to those who are, of course, very worried about domestic abuse and nonetheless not incurring too many additional expenses, or really any additional expenses, I believe, is what the sponsor of this legislation had said, because there are plenty of entities that are willing to go to, you know, cosmetology schools and such and teach this for free. It's finding that happy medium.
Makes a lot of sense. Last one we'll talk about is probably Jason Whiteside's favorite one, being from some of the nether regions of Illinois where he grew up. Finally, thank God, Illinois has come to their senses and has allowed people to use a pitchfork when hunting catfish. Thankfully, we've come to the point in our lives where we could do this, right, Amanda?
because you were out there both with tridents.
Well,
because
before Rich, I was already.
Rich was doing it so wrong that one time we went hunting with catfish. It was embarrassing.
I was using a traditional fish rod, but apparently you could already before this new law, you could already do it for carp, buffalo, suckers, gar, bowfin, shad, and drum. I'm not even
Rich
sure
is reading
some of those
that as
are,
if they're names that he's well, never ever recognized before.
I like, as a Jewish man, I mean, I like a nice piece of whitefish. I'm not sure.
But you like for someone
I'm
else
to sure
hunt
how
it,
it's
kill
caught
it,
or,
put it on the plate.
I like to go to the deli and order a nice piece of whitefish. Where it comes from or what kind of spearage is used, I'm not really interested, but tell us about
it's
this
also
new
underwater spear guns, bows and arrows. There's a whole lot of devices you can use besides a fishing rod, evidently. Don't know. I will add that I, for one, took part in another method, and this past year, for the first time, took part in the Asian carp.
Oh, yeah.
Tournament.
Did you bow
hunt?
Oh,
yeah. It was awesome.
Did you use a bow?
No, I did not use a bow. It was actually not really I wasn't so good at it, and sadly, this year, it's not supposedly that the Asian carp population is down, but just due to the weather, there weren't enough waves that many of them were still riding low in the water and weren't all that jumpy. But I just had a net, and you had to try and net these suckers and throw them into the boat, and they were heavy. It did get bloody, and I did wear a helmet. So there you go.
All right. Well, we learn something new every day with every guest, don't we? That's Amanda Vinicky from WTTW, a correspondent. Welcome to the Chicago media family, and now you're a correspondent for Legal Faceoff, too, whether you like it or not.
Glad to
We will never leave you alone.
In the city and on your podcast. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Amanda.
Happy 2017 and enjoy all those new laws. Follow the law, everybody.
Legal grab bag time on Legal Face Off, WGN Plus with Rich and Jason. We've got seven topics today: Donald Trump, Dylan Roof, Eric Holder, Rod Blagojevich, FaceTime, a new French law, and my favorite one, Run DMC takes on Walmart. But we start with the president-elect, Donald Trump, who's being deposed in New York, a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against a chef.
Yeah, yesterday he was deposed. It only took about an hour, but he tried to get out of it. He argued that, you know, obviously he's unlike many other defendants and shouldn't be subject to a lawsuit.
Because he's the greatest.
Yeah, because he's the hugest of all time. They said that he was, quote, extremely busy handling matters of very significant public importance. But unfortunately, the judge ordered him to sit for the deposition. So that's why he did it yesterday. As you mentioned, it's a civil case resulting from Trump Tower. I think it's the Washington Hotel.
Yeah.
He had an agreement with a celebrity chef, Jose Andres, who's been on, I think, Top Chef a couple times. Andres, the suit alleges he pulled out from the agreement to open a restaurant in the hotel. And Andres countersued, saying that he made it impossible, that Trump made it impossible to continue because of his anti-Hispanic statements. This would be a Hispanic restaurant, so the chef argued that we couldn't proceed with the contract because of the way Trump has acted. This deposition proceeded. Jose Andres yesterday tweeted, "Let's just resolve it."
Yeah, he tweeted at like 4:30 in the morning. Mr. Trump, if
Which
you're awake.
Which is Trump time, though, right? I mean, that's
Trump doesn't ever sleep. Yeah,
that's Trump.
It's like, if you're awake, let's donate the money to charity and settle this thing. But what does that mean? Does that mean he's going to open the restaurant again then in Trump, that D.C. Hotel?
Yeah, I mean, I think they moved on with another restaurateur. There's also a restaurant again. I should say there's also a suit against another celebrity chef, Jeffrey Zakarian, who also pulled out of a restaurant project in the old post office building.
Yeah.
Trump has very famously said on the stump, on the campaign stump, that he doesn't settle, that once you settle, you're sued all the time. Although we just saw him settle the
for $25 million, the Trump University case.
So, you know, I think this will settle. He doesn't want to have to face depositions in other cases. I think there's only been five or six sitting presidents, including, you know, Bill Clinton, who have given depositions while in office. So Trump wants to avoid that. He'll probably settle.
It'll be interesting to see. I don't know. Have any ever given civil depositions while they're sitting in office? I mean, I know Clinton gave a deposition for other matters, but I'm curious to see what the court system would do if they did bring a suit against a sitting president.
Yeah, I mean, they always argue, of course, that
it's a matter of, you know, security and all that good stuff.
Right, but I think probably won't get to that just given the presence of him, paying a lot of money to settle the Trump U suit. This is a smaller one, so I think I'll probably settle this one.
Dylan Roof is a white supremacist, mass murderer. He was the one with the Charleston church back in June of 2015. He's been cold to his victims. He apologized to his parents. And last check, deliberations in the death penalty trial are going to start on Tuesday, Jason?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. He didn't actually apologize to his parents for what he did. He just apologized for the repercussions that his actions would cause, but has shown no remorse whatsoever towards any of the victims. And they found a journal that they went through, and I mean, he pretty much hates everyone. I mean, I don't think he likes anyone at all. But he had gone on, you know, obviously racism against African Americans. He blamed, he had a rant in there about the Jews too, how they made America worse. But just a, you know, it seems like a cold-blooded, calculated killer who shows no remorse whatsoever.
Yeah, and the interesting thing was in the hearing this week, he said to the jury, "Don't believe everything my lawyer told you about my, you know, psychological state," because
he's completely sane about it all.
Well, remember, they were trying to argue that he was not responsible because of, you know, some psychological issues. He told the jury this week, "Don't believe any of that. I'm fine. I knew exactly what I was doing, and I have no remorse for it."
Yeah, so I'm sure sentencing is going to go in accordance with that.
Now, how long before the needle goes in? How long is that process?
You know, that takes years, generally, yeah, because of the appeal process. One of the big criticisms always of the capital punishment system is it actually takes
about, know, 10
a
years.
Long time, yeah, because obviously you've got to work your way through the appellate process.
And I think every capital case is automatically goes
exactly
to the appellate court,
yeah,
for a review. So whether he wants it or not, it's going to go there.
And he will appeal.
Well, whether or not he wants to appeal, it will be appealed. So even if he doesn't file the appellate court reviews it no matter what.
California Democratic state leaders have announced they've hired former Obama Attorney General Eric Holder as an outside counsel as California prepares to fight against the Trump administration.
Yeah, really interesting. So, you know, we all know that California voted Democrat. They usually do. They're a very blue state. California has a very robust legal staff. They've got a huge budget. They've got many people who work in the state attorney general's office. Despite that, it was announced yesterday that, as you mentioned, Eric Holder, who's a former attorney general, served under President Obama, a very controversial figure for a number of reasons, was hired. He's now works for the Covington and Burling firm. He joined them last year. And he was hired, and he and his firm were hired, as outside counsel by the Democratic Party of California to basically fight Trump administration protocols.
Yeah, for things that haven't even happened yet. It's like anticipation of what they think is going to occur.
Yeah, and you know, specifically with regard to, I mean, the biggest issue will be...
Yeah, they say economy, climate change, health care, civil rights, and immigration. But I'm sure immigration is the number one issue they're going to fight him on.
Yeah, and you know, this comes in the wake of the former California Attorney General Kamala Harris just being elected to the U.S. Senate. The governor of California is a Democrat, Jerry Brown, a long-serving governor, former presidential candidate. He's nominated another Democrat for the Attorney General job, but you know, it's almost a slap in the face to the Attorney General to have to hire a prominent former federal Attorney General to handle the outside work.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Not cheap either, by the way.
No, I'm sure Eric Holder's law firm is not charging $500 an hour.
Yeah, they'll be doing pretty well there in California.
Former Illinois governor and embattled prisoner Rob Blagojevich, currently in year 4 of a 14-year prison term out in Colorado, and his wife Patty is clinging to a hope of possibly presidential help from the outgoing President Barack Obama.
Yeah, you know, they've submitted a request to President Obama for a commutation of his sentence, at least to reduce it so that he could, I mean, I'm sure their hope is to reduce it to the time that he's actually served. But only the president is the one that has the power to do that. So, you know, so Blagojevich has submitted to Obama for that. But it's interesting, they have a pretty complicated history where Blagojevich, actually, when Obama got elected, Blagojevich was a pretty big star with the Democratic Party here in Chicago, and about a month later was indicted and went down the path that he went to. So, and then, of course, there's always the phone conversations between Blagojevich and Rahm that I'm sure aren't going to help.
Effing Golden, right?
Yeah, Effing Golden.
Also a connection to Trump, was a contestant on The Celebrity Apprentice.
Yeah, and Trump said he had a hell of a lot of guts to go through the trial that he went through. So
maybe Trump will pardon him. But, you know, Obama has, as we've covered on this show, been setting a record pace for commutations. But usually for drug offenses, you know, his idea is that you shouldn't be serving these long sentences for drug offenses. But yesterday, a lot of us saw the Carol Marine interview. You also mentioned that there was one on CBS.
A Jay Levine interview, too.
Of the president, where he was asked, the last question that Carol Marine that I saw asked him was, will you commute Blagojevich's sentence? And Obama gave, you know, sort of the answer that you would expect, that I don't discuss these things, that there's a process involved. And he did say that the commutations that he've done has been for drug offenses. So, I don't know. Yeah. What do you guys think? I don't think he's going to do it. I think it's too hot of an issue, and I don't think he has that connection. We've seen presidents do this in the past. You know, Clinton did a very famous one when he left. But
who was that?
More
who was that guy? The heavy
Rich.
Democratic lender, or donor.
Yeah, that was Thomas Rich that commuted. But
I don't see Obama doing it. There's not that close of a connection here, and there's actually probably more of a disconnect than a connection here.
I don't think they were very tight ever.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, it's. I think it's pretty Blagojevich and Rahm obviously don't have a great relationship, and Rahm has a great relationship with Obama. I don't see it, but it doesn't. It's presidents just historically do this in the last month of their term or last 2 months of their term, pretty much. I mean, I believe they do it simply because they're out of office. They don't care in another month if there's heat on them. But there's nothing to say that Trump can't step in and day one, you know, commute the sentence or pardon him. So
yeah, we're talking about it. You know, I think. From a practical perspective, whether they have a relationship. I mean, of course, you know, the president and his staff would tell you that the basis of doing that is simply whether the sentence is fair and whether justice would be served by pardoning it. You know, he's going to be in jail now until 2024. So, you know, there's a chance that Obama looks at that, and despite the fact that several courts have now said that this sentence is fair, there's a chance that Obama looks in and says, I disagree. But, yeah, I think we all are on the same page. That probably won't happen.
Apple is in some heat. A family has filed a lawsuit against the company, blaming FaceTime for their daughter's death.
Yeah, just cover this extensively on Bill and Wendy.
Who?
No, really?
Actually, Mike and Wendy. Bill is out. But yeah, there's a lot of callers who were unhappy with the idea that you would
sue. Well, if you get too many callers next time, just let me know, and I'll come on.
Yeah, good. They were unhappy with the idea that you would sue a company like Apple over someone not using FaceTime properly. So the backstory here is Apple's being sued by a couple whose five-year-old daughter was killed in a car crash. The allegation is that it happened when an SUV crashed into the back of their car. The driver, the lawsuit alleges, was using FaceTime at the time. This, you know, I think we would all agree maybe seems a little frivolous, but what I will say is that Apple actually had technology. They filed a patent in 2008 that would disable FaceTime when driving. Just didn't follow through with it.
It's not unreasonable. You guys have all used Waze, right? You cannot use Waze if you're driving in your car.
Unless you just hit that one-second button that says, I'm a passenger. Yeah. What an incredible thing.
But it shows you that motion technology is out there. Yeah. And it's totally able to be used. But, you know, and like you said, Apple filed for the patent in 2008, so they've sat on this for 8 years now. Why it's not enabled, I don't know, but you know, we'll see. Was the lawsuit filed in California?
I don't know where it was filed.
Because I know that California enjoys some pretty protective laws of you know,
Santa Clara Community or Santa Clara County Superior Court in California.
Yeah, so I mean, California has some pretty protective laws of patent and you know, other work. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out through this lawsuit.
I mean, you see technology already in cars. Like my GPS in my car won't allow you to use it if you're going over like 10 miles an hour.
Right. Yeah, you can't even. Some vehicles won't even allow you to program it. But then, you know, one of my cars, you press a button that says confirm that you're not driving.
Let's repeat that. In one of your cars. You're a real man of the people. Go ahead.
You only own one vehicle, right, Rich?
It's like a beat-up 72 Dodge Dart. Go
ahead. Volkswagen you take around the country?
Yeah, the last time I saw his driver step out of like a very long BMW. So but yeah, it's I mean, there's the technology's there for it. So
yeah, I mean, the question – yeah, I agree. I think the question isn't whether the technology is there, but obviously whether Apple should have a responsibility to do that in the face of people not – being responsible. We'll all agree that it's not responsible to use FaceTime when driving.
I drive down the expressway and down the streets of Chicago 6 out of 7 days a week. I see people eating. Yeah. I see people texting.
So do you sue food? Calling. So would you sue McDonald's and Burger King for selling food?
No, it's
that people eat?
It's common sense.
Right, exactly.
What are you doing eating a full pizza while you're operating a vehicle?
Exactly. I mean, you could. It doesn't even have to be technology. I mean, you could go back to people. We just talked about. You could go back to people who turned on the radio and it's 1972 to listen to music and were distracted. Would you sue a disc jockey for putting music on the radio?
You know,
it's
if this
personal
could prevent,
responsibility.
If this could prevent an innocent 5-year-old from dying, then they should enact it. If they have the technology for it, it's not like the 5-year-old was FaceTiming. She wasn't the one at fault here. So if it protects one 5-year-old from dying, then I'm all for it.
Wow. That's quite a heartfelt statement.
Follow
from,
that up.
Yeah.
I'll try my best.
Boom. We on all to get the next topic.
We all get emails after work hours, especially from Rich.
Yeah.
A new French law is barring work email after hours. It
I
is,
think the BDL Associates petition.
Thank God
for this
we
one.
Don't live in Paris, is all I'm going
to
say.
So it's establishing the workers' right to disconnect.
Come on. BDL law is now going to have a Come Paris on. Branch so that all the associates can.
Wah.
The goals of the law include making sure employees are fairly paid for work and preventing burnout by protecting private
it
time.
It applies to companies with more than 50 employees. They have to establish hours when the staff should not send or answer emails, which is tremendous. But yeah, they want to. They say that.
Wait, you think it's tremendous?
I mean, if you have more than 50 employees,
yeah,
I think it's great.
This is awesome watching this sort of build over the course of this. No, but I mean, I get emails all the time because a lot of the sporting events are after 5 o'clock, so my hours are different. They're always going to be crazy. But for law firms, you disagree, right?
Listen, it's a 24/7 world, my friends. You know this more than ever, and. You know, work is not restricted to 9 to 5. If it was, then, a lot of us would be out of business. My clients ask me questions literally at all hours of the night. I mean, they can call me anytime.
Even though we're on opposite sides, I mean, my clients are the same way. I mean, they're texting, they're calling, they're, emailing. I mean, it's as business owners, you just can't do that. You can't restrict your time.
I couldn't tell, a Fortune 100 company that I work for that, hey, it's 5:01. And I don't want to respond because this is my time. I'd be out of work. So if that applies to me, my feeling is it should apply to everyone if you want to, succeed. I get the idea that you want personal time and you don't want to abuse it by texting someone at like 3 a.m. that works for you. But, within reason, I think it's fine.
So maybe our careers are a little different. It's hard for us to relate. But what about the...
Well, I mean, you can relate because you are on the clock at all hours of the...
Well, I just mean for the average 9-to-5 worker, though, they might have a problem with this.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think everyone to an extent, who has a job feels some responsibility to be a service provider. It's a customer service world. So even if you're not in a, job that requires you to work, after hours, I think if you've got a reasonable employer and they ask you a question at 6 o'clock, most people feel some responsibility to do so. I think the problem
with what Rich and I do, though, too, I mean, with litigation, it's a time clock's always in your head. So you feel like you have to respond to everything. Communication has to be prompt. It has to be done as quickly as possible. So, I mean, him and I respond very, very quickly with it. But maybe other industries, not so much. I don't know. Maybe, I know Europe has a sense of, they enjoy life more.
Slower in
less.
France. It's, things are a little slower.
Kicking back, drinking wine, relaxing.
So no Whiteside and Goldberg, no Bryce Donny and Lenkov chapters opening up in
maybe.
Paris.
Nice, maybe. South of France.
Oh, that'd be beautiful. Let's do it.
I think we have an
legal
idea.
Face-off road trip.
Let's close up the grab bag with the heavy hitters. This is a huge heavyweight fight. Run DMC and Walmart. Did you ever think you'd pit those two sides against each other, Jay?
No, that's crazy. I didn't even know before, looking at this article, I didn't even know Walmart sold Run DMC apparel, which is unbelievable. Run DMC's filed a $50 million lawsuit in New York accusing Walmart, Amazon, Jet, and other retailers of selling products that were using the group's name without their permission. So they said it's been going back since the 80s. And they say that I think that they estimate that they've lost out on over $100 million in revenue that Walmart's generated since the 80s. So
that's pretty tricky.
I was going to ask, favorite Run DMC song?
For me, it's tricky. I've sang that one many an evening in a bar after a couple drinks.
mine's Sucker MCs.
Sucker MCs. Dude,
I have no
good.
Clue.
Nothing?
No? I don't even.
What?
Run DMC was so long ago.
Craig, Run DMC, what do you got for us? You got My Adidas, maybe?
No, I got nothing.
Before your time.
No, it's just because I didn't listen to a lot of Run DMC. It was during my time.
All right, that's it. What'd you guys do for New Year's?
Crown Royal.
New Year's? You were in Vegas for New Year's, weren't you?
I was. I took my kids to the Cirque du Soleil show, the Beatles one, and then they went to a Sting concert. So just a run-of-the-mill New Year's.
Just a typical New Year's Eve.
And you saw Ronda Rousey get her block knocked off.
I went to UFC 207. Sat through the whole undercard, which was a little bit slow, I think.
That's long, the undercard, then, for those.
48 seconds.
48 seconds of Ronda Rousey. I was kind of surprised they stopped it from being in the arena. I don't know, did you watch it, Sam?
I saw the highlights. Well, the highlight, I guess. It was one blow.
It was, I mean, she clearly was, like, not, I think, on her game. Her legs weren't there. She seemed mentally out of it. The woman who beat her, I forget her name at this point. Most people don't remember her name, I think, but... Yeah. She was great. I mean, I think she's, you know, probably...
She's a phenomenal striker, too, the woman that beat her. And, you know, that's not Ronda Rousey's game. I mean, her game is jiu-jitsu and, you know, judo and ground game, so...
Amanda Nunes.
And making movies. That's probably the problem.
Yeah.
It was Amanda Nunes,
right? Yeah, that's right.
Sounds like she's going to be
lioness.
She's going to be making a lot more movies than UFC fights coming up, so...
Yeah.
That's what we want, to see our athletes in movies, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, thanks to Craig Collins today for sitting in. For Rich, for Jason, my name is Sam. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy New Year from Legal Faceoff.